Hello, and welcome to episode 264 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me today is absolutely nobody. Today is a solo podcast. If you are following Andrew's Twitter feed, you know that he is out on the West Coast driving all over the place. Possibly he's in Oregon right now, but I don't know. There's a chance he doesn't even know what state he's in right now. Because the inputs to this podcast include time and internet, and Andrew has had very little of either of those recently, we decided that I should just do episode 264. So that is what I will do. It may be a very short show. It may be a somewhat longer show. I will start talking. I have a bunch of notes. And one thing that I have learned from teaching is that the function from notes and lecture preparation to the length of the lecture output is extremely unpredictable. So I find myself grateful for the podcast format, where I do not have the constraints of an academic schedule to bind me so strictly. So if you are going to sign off now and wait until next week's show, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And if not, buckle up, we're going to talk about a hand from the World Series of Poker. And that's how we're going to do it this episode. We're going to build it around one hand, and I will use that as a jumping off point to talk about a few concepts. And I hope that you get clear about something that the poker world has been wondering about. And the poker world has been wondering about what the heck happened to Phil Ivey in the World Series of Poker main event. Why did he bluff off all those chips? My answer is, I don't know, but I think I can help you be a little less confused than you are now, if you are confused about it. And if you are not yet confused about it, if you don't even know that this hand exists, you may find that you go from not being confused to being confused to being a little bit less confused. Again, this is often just what education looks like. Okay, before we do that, I would like to thank, as always, Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge is a video training website. You sign up, there's a free trial. After that, you give them, I believe, $25 a month and some amount of your time. And what you get out of that is access to their poker videos that you spend your time watching. A lot of people think that this is an extremely good deal. What they get out of this is worth much, much more than $25. We have Andrew making videos. He is usually too modest to talk about how good his videos are, although he usually lets you know that they exist. But trust me, if you think he is lucid and helpful on the podcasts, you should hear him when he is preparing his notes a little more a little more carefully, and it's not just him winging it with me. His videos are excellent, and while he's not here, I would like to just tell you how great they all are. So thank you, as always, to the fine, very kind folks at Tournament Poker Edge. If Carlos were here, he would tell you what a great community it is. Also, not just a place where you can get access to valuable materials, but also just a very fine community. All right, on to the hand. This hand takes place in the World Series of Poker main event at the 5,000-10,000 chip blind level. The effective stack here is 75 to 80 big blinds, and that's very important. As always, it has effects down to preflop, so you should keep that in mind. Phil has about 77 big blinds. His opponent covers him. Phil is in middle position with the black nines. Nine of clubs, nine of spades, and Phil opens to 22,000 chips from, I believe, the cutoff. He is 3-bet by another gentleman by the name of Altman to 75,000 chips. It folds back around to him, that is Phil, and Phil calls. So, raised to 22,000 with two nines, a 3-bet to 75,000 with what turns out to be queen-jack offsuit, and a call. So already, there's a lot to talk about. I think Phil shouldn't really do anything other than raise here. Andrew and I talk a lot about opening with a limp with pocket pairs in tournament situations sometimes. When you have something as good as nines and when you're already in middle position, as opposed to, say, under the gun or under the gun plus one, and when you're going to take down the blinds with a raise fairly often, I think there's really no reason to limp. Certainly, folding is 10 miles out of the question, so raising is good. I don't know what Phil's standard raise size is or was. I strongly suspect he was making it 22,000 with his whole range, and I think that's a good size. So what's really interesting here is the 3-bet by Altman. And I want to say on the meta level that this has really been lost in a lot of the internet analysis surrounding this hand. One thing I like to say on the air is that a hand can take several minutes, and people often take it for granted that when they make a decision on the river at a poker table, they are taking into account all of the information, and they haven't forgotten everything. But I think often they do forget things, and even when they're just sitting at home watching a hand of poker, or even when they're reading a paragraph with all the information in it, and they get to the end of the paragraph, they have forgotten what's at the beginning of the paragraph. What happens pre-flop in this hand is very unusual, and it affects everything that happens in the hand after that. I don't know exactly how, but I do know that people who were talking on Twitter, on blogs, on fora, in other places about this hand almost universally did not pay enough attention to preflop. There are a few reasons why I think this. One key one here is the bet sizing. The bet sizing, 22,000 to 75,000. The 75,000 chip raise is between three and four times Phil's open. That is huge in position. It is a very large three bet. Now, I'm partly talking in theory, but I'm also talking about practice here. The standard three bet size is a lot smaller than this, and it's especially a lot smaller than this from people who fit Mr. Altman's demography. He is a young dude, maybe middle-aged. I'd guess he's about 30. I don't know why he made it so much, and I don't know why he 3-bet in the first place. I think this is a very strange play. This is not to say that Mr. Altman is a bad player. It is to say that I've been thinking about this hand for weeks now, and the more I think about it, the more clear I get about it, but I still do not find myself rushing to defend or even finding any good reasons to defend this 3-bet. What would a normal 3-betting range look like? Well, we don't know what an optimal one looks like, but a lot of the best players in the world do something like this. They fold some of their hands, they call some of their hands for the 22,000, and then they re-raise some of their hands, and they choose, usually in this spot, I believe, only one bet size to do that. And that bet size will often be about 60,000. Maybe some of them will go a little bit bigger, maybe 65. 75 is large, and I'm pretty confident that's larger than what most of the best players in the world would do. So, in theory, what should be true if your bet size is larger? Well, that's a tricky question, but a first answer is that it ought to be a range that has both strong hands and bluffs in it, but they should both be a bit narrower. Usually, if you think about, say, an open jamming range from the button, so let's say you're playing a jam fold strategy from the button, with 10 big blinds, you're going to move in with all your hands. If you increase the bet size, like if you have 13 big blinds and you're still going to move in with all your hands, put aside for a second the question of whether that's the right thing to do, but let's say you're still playing a jam fold strategy, but with a bigger bet size, you're going to have some weaker hands and some stronger hands, but both those ranges are going to be narrower. You're going to shove somewhat fewer hands with 13 big blinds than you would with 10 big blinds. Similarly, if you are choosing a larger 3-bet size, you should take some value hands out of your raising range and put them in your calling range. Also, probably some hands that you would fold become calls. Well, anyway, there are certainly some hands that you would 3-bet that you should turn into a call. So why on earth would you re-raise Queen Jack offsuit? So there are some reasons to re-raise a hand like that in general. I think the standard play is to call or fold that hand against a mid-position open, depending how tight you think the opener is. I think calling is pretty loose. I would lean toward folding. If I re-raised, it would usually be an unexploitive thing. Or it would be because I was choosing the queen and the jack as blockers, and I thought that it played well as a 3-bet, as a semi-bluff 3-bet. But I want to caution you that if you think that your opponent is opening a bit wide in middle position, and you look down at queen jack offsuit and you think, aha, I have two Broadway cards, I will re-raise this gentleman. You should be very careful about how many hands that is. If you're thinking that about Queen Jack, are you also going to be thinking that about King Jack, Ace Queen, Ace King? Now, Ace Queen and Ace King are maybe just obvious value 3-bets, certainly Ace King. But what about Queen Jun 10? What about Jack 10? What about King 10? Every one of those hands I'm mentioning, there are 16 combinations of. So if you are raising Queen Jack offsuit, you're probably re-raising lots and lots and lots and lots of hands, and in particular, a lot of weak hands. So that can be good to do as an exploitive thing. You can just raise too many hands, especially hands with blocker values, and if you think that somebody is opening too much, then not defending enough or defending the wrong way, if he gets 3-bet, you can just 3-bet him a lot. I would not do this against arguably the best poker player who ever lived. I don't think that great poker players are infallible. I don't think that geniuses are infallible. I am very, very sure that Phil Ivey is not one of these guys who's just opening too much and then thinks, I got re-raised. Guess I'll just fold. I don't think he's doing that. I think he has a very good sense of how people react to him when he raises. I think he has a very good sense of how players like Mr. Altman will react to him, and I think he's going to react well against that. And choosing a sort of simple, which is not to say, bad or stupid, but just simple exploitive response to somebody who's raising and who you might expect to be raising a lot, and that simple response being, I'm going to re-raise a lot and just take that money down. I think that's not going to work against Phil. So we already have a hand that's a bit of a weak 3-bet, and we're making our bet size larger, and we're still keeping Queen Jack offsuit in there. I don't think this re-raise makes sense for exploitive reasons, and I don't think this re-raise makes sense as a matter of optimal range construction at that bet size. And I also don't think that optimal play would use that bet size. So I'm not a great fan of this play, but I do think we need to think about it for a long time. And I think we should think about it for a long time because I've been talking about it for a long time because it affects everything that happens in the hand after that. I don't know what Mr. Altman's range was here, and I don't know what Phil Ivey's thoughts about that range were. I do know that he was thinking something. If I were playing against Phil Ivey, I would probably tighten up my range a little bit too. But yeah, Queen Jack offsuit is not part of a tight range. So there you go. I think Phil was right to call and not 4-bet against this 3-bet. I think nines is a good hand. I think if he had thought that the other player just had a huge, huge, huge hand all the time, he could fold. But the range you're playing against has to be very, very good before you can fold nines to a 3-bet. So Phil calls, and we go to the flop with 160 or so thousand chips in the pot. The flop is Queen of Clubs, Jack of Spades, Deuce of Spades. So Mr. Altman flops top two pair with the queen of trump, and Phil flops two nines with the nine of spades. Phil checks. I think this is really the only play. And then Altman bets 60,000 chips. So that's interesting. So let's think about the whole situation here. There's about 160,000 in the pot. There's about 700,000 in the effective stack. So the stack to pot ratio is about 4 to 1. So what is Mr. Altman doing by betting 60,000 here? So first thing to notice is that that's a very small bet. Very small bet. Much smaller than most people would use in most situations on a board this draw heavy. So that doesn't mean it's bad. One thing you can consider in draw heavy board situations is betting small, just to knock out the weakest hands. I think this is a common mistake in reasoning that I see, where people think that the only way to bluff and the only way to value bet or protect on a draw heavy board is to use a large bet size so as to put pressure on, say, open-ended straight draws or gut shots. And there are several errors of reasoning that are behind this mistaken belief. One of them is that, say, you can fold out the nut flush draw if you just, bet the full pot on the flop. Usually you can't. And people will say things like, "Oh, there were spades on board, so I bet a lot." And then I will sometimes say something like, "Which combinations of spade draws are you targeting? Like, which ones would this person have played pre-flop?" And it turns out that they're all the nut spade draw. So my interlocutor ends up claiming that he thinks he can fold out the nut flush draw and an overcard by betting, say, the full pot or 75% of the pot on the flop. And that's not something you can do. And often inflating the pot against a range that includes hands like that can be pretty bad. Sometimes it can be good, but sometimes it can be bad. So let's go back to the hand we're talking about. The flop is queen of clubs, jack of spades, deuce of spades. So, and we're in a three bet pot. So there are a lot of hands that hit this board, and a lot of hands have some equity on it. Ace king and an ace 10 are hands that have some combinations of overcards and gut shots. A lot of hands have a pair and some sort of three straight, some sort of running straight draw. A hand like 10-9 suited is very possible. I don't know what Phil does with that against a three bet, but not much folding maybe makes sense, especially if Phil thinks he has an edge in the post flop action. Certainly, if Altman is three betting Queen Jack offsuit, I wouldn't say that he would never three bet a hand like 10-9 suited, or even 10-9 offsuit. I mean, geez, if he's three betting a hand like Queen Jack offsuit, I don't know quite what's going through his head. And again, that's not meant to say that he's not thinking or he's stupid, just that he's doing something that's so different from what I would do and what I can find a really good justification for doing that I think I ought to use some modesty when I try to interpret the rest of what he's doing. So we have a queen jack deuce board and a lot of hands that have some equity on it. And one thing you can try to do on this board is put a lot of pressure on the ace 10 type hands, maybe the king jack type hands over a couple streets, 10-9, 10-8. That's one thing you can try to do, 10-9 without the spade draw. Another thing you can do is just try to fold out the real whiffs, like the ace 7, the pocket fours, just the hands that are really gonna be in bad shape on this board. You can try to build a range that gets a little bit of value, that, sorry, when you choose a bet size that is small, so that when you are betting that size with a value hand, you can get at least a little bit of value from worse hands, and maybe you'll get that from more hands because you're betting small. And when you're choosing that small bet size with your bluffs, you can still fold out some hands. Maybe And I've just listed some. A hand like ace 10 or pocket fours, something like that, could easily fold. I'm not saying those hands will fold all the time, but I think Altman had some reason for doing this. And I'm not sure that a small bet size, all things considered, makes sense here. But I think a good justification can be given for it. And I also think that among my poker students and my former poker students and people who write into the podcast and people I talk poker with over dinner and even myself, I think that betting automatically too much on draw heavy boards is a real mistake. And thinking that poker theory says that you should, not often, not usually, but always choose a larger bet size on a draw heavy board. That's a mistake. And it's nice to see a very public example of somebody choosing a small bet size in a situation where maybe that's nice. Another nice thing about this bet size is that it makes a check raise all in on the flop a little less appealing for Ivy. So again, there's about 160 in the pot. After the 60K that is bet on the flop is called, that's 120 plus 160 equals 280K with another about 640 behind effective. So it would be a large check raise all in. If Altman had done the, what for some people is a more standard bet of like 100 to 125, so you're adding 200 to 250 to that 160 that's already in the pot. So then you have more like 400 in the pot. And then it's like barely more than a pot-sized raise for Phil to check raise you all in. And if you think about Altman's range, there's going to be some ace king in there, maybe some ace jack. Not that he's betting those hands all the time or even much of the time, but you can construct ranges for Altman that have a lot of hands that don't want to get check raised. And one great thing to do in position is control the size of the pot and limit your opponent's choices in a way that is to your advantage. So I think that one benefit of the small bet size is that it makes it harder for Phil to raise really at all, because it's hard for Phil to raise without committing himself with any value hand. I mean, he could check raise with air, then fold to an all-in. But if he raises with a value hand, he's likely to be committed. And if he raises all in, which is what you might do if you're committing yourself anyway, he's making a large overbet. So this bet carries a lot of leverage, and I like it. However, he's doing this because he bet. Like, he's in this situation because he bet so much before the flop. So I think that a lot of these reasons to bet smaller on the flop are also reasons not to do the non-standard thing of raising more before the flop. So Phil is facing that 60K bet with two black nines. So there are two overcards to your nines, and these pocket pairs with overcards, that's a hand that a lot of people defend too much to continuation bets. So a lot of people would rather call here with two nines than with a hand like Ace King. And often the Ace King is going to be a much better hand to call with here. And that's because it has much more improvability when it's behind. And it also has as much or more equity when it's ahead. And it's ahead almost as often as the two nines are. So if you are, and again, this is not something I'm making up, this is something I hear all the time from poker interlocutors. If you often choose your pocket pairs to put in a like the weaker end of a calling range on the flop in a spot like this, when there are overcards to the pocket pair, I would urge you to do some thinking, do some work on this subject, and think about whether there are unpaired card hands that would be doing a better job for you. And I would also look at your psychology to try to make sure whether you aren't just calling because you feel like you got a premium or a very good starting hand, and then you hit a bad flop and you feel like you can't or shouldn't or are entitled not to fold on the flop. So I think it's important to realize that nines are a bit worse on this flop than a lot of players think they are. The two overcards really hurts you a lot, and all those straight draws have tons of equity against the nines, even though the nines block some of those straightening cards. Now, all that said, I mean, Phil is well aware of this. He's getting a great price, and his opponent's range has a lot of ace king in it, probably has some ace 10 in it, very likely has some lower pocket pairs in it. Not very likely, but if it has queen jack offsuit, it's probably got some other sort of miscellaneous things in it. And nines beats a lot of miscellaneous things. So I certainly don't fault him for calling the 60K into a big pot. One thing about the small bet is not only that more hands will call it, but that more hands are correct to call it. I think nines is a pretty uncontroversial call here. If you have a read that your opponent is a little bit less likely to be bluffing, then you can make a nice, tight, disciplined fold here. Like nines is only correct to call with. Because your price is so good, and because there is, at least in theory, that very real chance that your opponent is bluffing. So, if you think that your opponent is in always has it mode, or just if you think that he's a bit more likely to be paired than usual, go ahead and fold here. It's, I think, a clearly correct call with the nines, but not a call that's correct by much. So if you've got that extra information, this is a time to realize that the clearly correct play is only correct by a bit. Yeah, that margin has been consumed by this read that you have, so you're just going to go ahead and fold your nines. That would be a fine play. That said, Phil calls. Phil makes the standard play here, and I think Phil's play makes a lot of sense. On to the turn. The turn is the eight of spades, making the board queen of clubs, jack of spades, deuce of spades, eight of spades. That is pretty close to the joker, as they say. It brings in the flush draw, and it also brings in one of the two straight draws. Brings in the straight draw with 10-9. Phil checks. I think this is a reasonable play. He has reasons to think about bluffing with his hand, but donking out on the turn is, for a few reasons, not the best way to do that, I think. But we'll talk about this hand more from Phil's perspective soon. When it gets to Mr. Altman, he has an interesting decision. So he has top two pair on this very draw-heavy board in a bloated pot. Why should he bet? Well, he should bet first to get value from worse hands, and most hands are still worse than his. So it's easy to look and see the flush, look and see the straight, look and see maybe a set, I don't know. But two pair is a very good hand. It beats a lot of no pair hands. It beats a lot of one pair hands that are plausible for Phil. So betting for value, sure. And betting for protection. So there are some offsuit hands, including pocket pairs, that Phil can have. There are hands with straight draws that Phil can have, such as the one he actually has. And you would like to bet to charge those hands. So those are fairly intuitive, I think, reasons to bet, to get value from worse hands and to make hands with equity fold. Why should he check? Well, one reason to check is that he has other hands that want to check behind. Maybe pocket aces. Well, that's a tricky case, but a hand like ace jack will often want to check behind here. There are some no pair hands that want to check behind, but have some value and would not like to get bluffed out on the river. There are other one pair hands that are like that too. And you would like to have some strong hands in this range to balance those out. And you might think that Queen Jack is pretty good for that purpose, especially given that Altman has the Queen of Spades. It's a little bit more likely that the fourth spade will come in, and even if it does come in, Altman has a pretty good flush. not having the ace or king is bad in a three bet pot when you're talking about how good your flush is. But still, the third nuts is a lot more than nothing. And if you're choosing some combinations of queen jack to check behind, checking behind the ones with the queen of spades seems like a pretty good start to me. So that would be why you would check behind, because you think that this two pair hand is good for protection and that your range needs some protection, especially since you have, or at least you might think you would have a range that would like to check behind at least some hands. So that's really tough. I don't know exactly how you should play this turn if you're Altman. I think I would bet here. It's tough. It's tough. I worry that I don't have enough strong hands in my check back range if I'm doing that. But yeah, aces with the ace of spades, kings with the king of spades, though those could all be candidate hands to check back. A hand like ace queen, especially if you have a spade, that could be a nice hand to put in your check back range. You could also consider putting a hand like the nuts in your check back range. Like the nuts will block. There are a lot of nutted hands here. And by nutted, I mean hands that are the nuts, hands that are literally the ace of spades and another spade that not only beat everything, but also block a lot of the flushes that your opponent could have, and a lot of the hands with flush draws that your opponent could have, and also a lot of the hands with straight draws that your opponent could have. So like ace king suited, ace ten suited, those hands are like that. Ace queen, which also blocks like a pair. And especially given that we're in a three bet pot and Phil is not so likely to have a hand like two pair or even a set. I think that there's a pretty good argument for choosing the nuts, at least sometimes, for your check back range. So those are all reasons to choose hands other than this one to put in your value check back range. But it's tricky. I'm not going to pretend to know exactly how to play this. And again, that is because preflop is so weird. Preflop is very unusual. I don't know what to make of Altman's range. I don't know what Phil thought Altman's range was. I don't know what Altman thought Phil's range was. And you get to the turn, these two and a half, these 2 to 2.5 SPR spots, those can be very tricky too, because just shoving, that's pretty big. And betting probably half pot, leaving a significant a river bet behind is something that Altman could have done. Like that's one way to break up an SPR of 2 into 2 streets. So that makes sense. I think if he bets this turn and gets jammed on, he should not fold. I think this is a terrible hand to bet fold. So that's another reason for checking, is if you think that Phil is not only going to be putting you in a tough spot when you check raise, but that's going to be happening often enough to care about that possibility, then you should keep Phil from being able to do that. I didn't mention it before because it's pretty hard for it simultaneously to be true that Phil is that it's happening a lot and that it's putting you in a tough spot. You just have such a good hand. I think if you bet, you need to just call, and I think you're going to be ahead pretty often when that happens. But the board's done a lot of the work of making a flush and a straight. Phil's allowed to make flushes and straights. Some of the flushes are less likely given how big the pre-flop re-raise was, and also some of the straights are less likely. Phil could have. I know I said that he probably wasn't folding 10-9 suited, but he's more likely to do that to 75K than to 60K, I'm pretty sure. So that's another reason just to close your eyes and call. Or even fist pump call, maybe, if you bet here and get jammed on. So I think ultimately I would bet. I would also like to bluff here, like a hand like ace king. It's a hand I could have. Ace 10, ones with no spade or ones with one spade. It's a little trickier. But especially if Altman has Queen Jack offsuit. He should have some whiffs here, and he should have some hands with a little bit of equity, but not so much equity that he can happily check, and so he should want to bluff here. So we should not only be thinking, oh, sometimes we want to check here, let's make sure we find some hands that are good to check with. We should also be thinking, oh, we're going to want to bluff here, let's make sure we find some, let's make sure we have enough value hands. And especially since there will be some temptation to check behind with a lot of our aces and kings and ace queen, then maybe we should make sure that we're betting queen jack. So that's tricky. It's a very tough combinatorics question. It's a tough theory question. I know I haven't seen anyone give a really good analysis of it. If you have thoughts about this, I would be very curious to hear them. Podcast@thinkingpoker.net. But the turn is tricky. The whole hand is tricky. What I would really implore you not to do is to think about it without also thinking about preflop. The river is the three of diamonds, making the board queen of clubs, jack of spades, deuce of spades, eight of spades, three of diamonds. The three of diamonds is about as big of a brick as could have come there. Phil Ivey is holding two black nines. He did not make his one card flush on the river. He didn't make his one card straight on the river. He is left with just a pair of nines. After getting three bet preflop and facing the flop bet, and the turn check, those nines will be good sometimes, but not all that often. So Phil has, the standard questions to consider. Does he want to be bluffing with his range? And if so, how? And does he want to be bluffing with this part of his range? And if so, how? Now, the stack to pot ratio is just under 1.5. There are 629K in the effective stacks. It's something like 430 in the pot. Now, I would like to suggest that if you're going to bluff with two nines here, check raising is a pretty nice way to do it. The raise is going to have a lot of weight. So with a 1.5 SPR stack size, sometimes if you check, you're going to face a bet so big that your opponent will be priced in, but very often you're going to face roughly a half pot size bet, something like that. And when you move all in, your opponent will have pretty good pot odds, but especially given the tournament situation, he may be inclined to slightly overfold. So this gets back to what Dan Harrington called first in vigorish way back in the day. And he was talking about preflop and about moving all in preflop, but it applies in other situations too. And it's a well-known fact that because tournaments are what they are, and the bottom chips in your stack are worth so much more than the top ones, at least most of the time, that there are just a lot of benefits of being the guy who goes all in. One of those is that you get to apply more power than the pot odds would suggest. So, and this is sort of a sweet spot for that with the 1.5 SPR situation, where if you can make something like a half pot or two-thirds pot check raise all in, and your opponent A has to pay attention to the ICM considerations, or more generally just the tournament chip value considerations, and second might just be scared, might just not want to go home, especially on ESPN. So I think check raising is a pretty good way to bluff with this hand. Another reason check raising is a pretty good way to bluff with this hand is that your bluff target is at least one pair. And a lot of one pair hands, especially the ones that are betting instead of checking behind, are really good. So, Phil might want to communicate that he has a very big hand, and check raising, putting all that money in can tell that story effectively. Now, is two black nines, is that a good hand to bluff with? Well, let's think of the reasons for and against. A reason not to bluff with this hand is that it has some showdown value. That's a perfectly good consideration, but I would warn you, as we have warned you on this show many times, not to just assume you have showdown value where not much might exist, and also to always look for the best play, not just a play you can find some old justification for. And here, whether the three betting range is strong or weak, by the time you face the three bet and the flop bet, nines is not going to be good all that often. The turn check is a trickier thing to interpret. We'll get back to that later. But I think there may be some good reasons to worry most about showing down the nines, but I think turning them into a bluff is not a bad idea, especially since there should be plenty of one pair in your opponent's range. And if your opponent looks at the queen jack eight deuce three board, and that a board with a flush on it also, it should be very possible to convince your opponent, or to at least suggest to your opponent, that you can beat one pair. So with two black nines, Phil's got a hand with showdown value, but maybe not too much showdown value. One thing that I think a lot of you probably will have thought of already, but certainly not all, and that's more than okay, is that nines have good blocker value here. Phil has the nine of spades. Some of that will be in Altman's betting range, so the nine really does have some blocker value. And the two nines, just the rank of the nines, means that he's blocking plenty of the straights. So maybe it's not the best blocker hand you could have, but he has two relevant blockers. And in some sense, he has three. He has two straight blockers and a flush blocker, if you want to think of it that way. So Phil's got a hand that he could really consider turning into a bluff. And checking, I think, is nice for a few reasons. Even though you're not going to be ahead a lot, sometimes it will go check, check, and you win. So that's good. It's probably not much better than if you bet when you're ahead, if you're not going to get bluff raised. I mean, you could get bluff raised, but probably not a lot of people with in this spot with ranges that look like the two players' ranges look like. Not many people, I think, are going to jam over a Phil Ivey bet here. I could be wrong about that, but that's just my sense of the ranges and how these situations work. So I don't think that the possibility of winning without bluffing is a reason to check instead of bet, but it's also not a reason to bet instead of check. And if you're going to bluff, I think check raising, as I've said, is a pretty good way to do it, given these stack sizes. So I'd like Phil's check here. And Altman has a really good hand. He's got two pair. Phil has checked a lot of times now. He's checked on every post-flop street. He should certainly think that two pair can be good here. And I like his choice to bet. He chooses to bet 195,000 into the pot. It's about 40% of the pot. I think this is fine. I think bigger is fine. If I were bluffing, I might go a little bit bigger, so I would probably go a little bit bigger with the bet here. May also have the function of discouraging a jam if I go bigger. Not sure whether that's good or bad, because if I get jammed on, I think I'm calling here with this hand. So that's another thing to think about. But I think 195K into 430K or whatever it was, roughly that, 45, 40, 50% of the pot, anywhere in there, I think has merit. And Phil does decide to pull the trigger and move all in for a 629K total. And again, I think this is one of those sweet spot bets. This bet puts a lot of pressure on his opponent. So, 200, 400, there's like 830 plus the raise. The opponent's getting about 3 to 1 on this call, but really can fold sometimes. Queen Jack will have a hard time folding, I think, because it's so strong. And because it has the Queen of Spades blocker to some value hands. So I think Queen Jack is not a hand Phil is trying to move his opponent off of, but yeah, I think the bet is good, and I think the check raise is good. Now, a lot of people have said that Phil lost his mind here. Now, I don't know what's in my own heart. I certainly don't know what's in another person's heart. I doubt. I strongly doubt. Especially, you can go look at the video. I doubt. If you hear my cat, he also doubts that Phil just completely lost his mind here. I don't think that's what Phil was thinking. And I think there's been some pretty weak analysis of this river spot that makes claims that are just not true. There are many things I could debunk here, but I'll focus on one claim, and that's that it was clear Phil had nothing because he checked every time after the flop. I don't think that's a fair criticism of Phil's play. The reason I don't think it's fair is that not all four passive action lines are created equal, and I think this argument rests on the tacit assumption, maybe I'm being overcharitable here, that a line that contains four passive actions, that is just calling pre-flop instead of four betting, checking the flop, checking the turn, and checking the river, can't have very many strong hands in it. So I think this is a mistaken criticism for a few reasons. One is simple, and that's just that really good players have balanced ranges. If you watched the Aria Super High Roller Bowl, you saw Z Justin, Justin Bonomo, checking behind with the nuts and generally balancing his ranges very well. I can think of a lot of hands where I've seen very good players check several times, not just once, but several times with their good hands. And actually, I think this is something that sets a lot of the very best players apart from the merely good ones. I can remember CTS advocating for this on forum threads, maybe a decade ago, and that's just one example. It was just this nothing pot. It was like raise call in a heads up pot. Then it went check, 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 and on the river, the out of position player had the nuts, and Cole said, "What? This is an obvious check. No, check raising almost dominates betting out." And some other people said, "Ah, but how can you check with the nuts? You're just gonna let somebody see all those cards for free." And I think CTS was right, and his critics were wrong in that thread. And I think you see the very best players checking many times with their nutted hands more than you see merely good players doing that. So that's the sort of obvious theory point, is that even after you check several times, you have a range that includes some very good and very bad hands, and often you want to put some nutted hands in both the aggressive and the passive portions of your range. There are exceptions to that, but very often it's true. And this hand here on the river is not an exception to that. But there are also some more more interesting and more specific to this hand considerations that also suggest that Phil may be unusually likely to have some very good hands in his four passive action line. One of them, again, is the pre-flop bet sizing. The stack size after Phil gets three bet is a little bit awkward, especially because this could be a sign of a polarized range. Here it's not, but if you take a sort of superposition or combination of all the possible ranges that Phil could be getting three bet by, I think that will be polarized with sort of probabilistic portions of a lot of hands, like say Queen Jack offsuit, and more often represented very big hands like aces, kings, ace king, hands like that, and bluffs too. But big hands overrepresented. And it's hard for Phil to four bet with any consistency without opening, or sorry, not with any consistency. It's hard for him to four bet to a size that put that gives him any four fold equity without opening himself up to the possibility of a five bet all in. And this would be a little bit less true if he had been three bet to a slightly smaller size. So I think that a lot of players, myself included, and maybe even Phil Ivey included, would have just called this pre-flop three bet a lot and chosen to themselves four bet with a polarized range, their very strongest hands, and then a few bluffs. That's what I would have done, And I think there's some evidence that Phil Ivey would have done that also, given that he just called with a hand as good as two nines, which is a very good hand, especially, with anties. It's also something we haven't talked about yet. I believe this is the 5,000, 10,000, 1,000 level. So the anties were probably like slightly small here, which it doesn't change too much, but Phil's opening range should be like a little bit tighter, and the three bet range should be correspondingly a little bit tighter, which makes the big three bet even a little bit more unusual. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but we should at least think about the ante. So I think Phil could call with a hand as good as Jack's here sometimes, at least sometimes pre-flop. And I wouldn't be completely surprised if he had just called with two queens. I think I would just call with the Jacks very often here. And I think with the queens, I could see myself four betting, and I could also see myself just calling in this spot. And that's not to say that what I'm doing is what Phil Ivey would do. I certainly wouldn't say that. And it's also not to say that what I am doing is what one should do. Also not saying that. But when we're thinking about the river decision, I think it's worth noting that sets will be in Phil's range, maybe a little bit more than you might expect. I think a lot of us see the Queen Jack Deuce board and we say, like, oh, Queens and Jacks, those are going to be in the three bettors range and not the callers range. Here, I'm not so sure that's true. Deuces is a trickier question. I think Phil probably, hard to know what to do with that before the flop. I think it's in theory a fold, but if you have a very good read on or good control over your opponent, I wouldn't be too surprised to see a call here. Finally, there's a very simple rule I like to use when bluffing sometimes. It's that if my hand looks a lot like a hand that's good, maybe it's plausible that I have that really good hand. So it's the eight that turned. The nine could have turned. Maybe I would have done the same thing with eights as I would have with nines. I think probably going into the turn, it's just about as easy for Phil to have eights as it is for him to have nines. There's some chance he would have folded like red eights on the flop, but I don't think so, not to that small bet size. So I think that's another good hand Phil can have going into the turn is a set of eights. So there's at least two streets that we've accounted for with some sets from Phil. I also think like I've already expressed before a little bit of uncertainty about what Phil would have done with 10-9 suited, but it's at least possible that he gets to the flop with it. And I don't think he's folding on the flop, like especially against that bet size. I can't really see him raising or folding with 10-9 hearts. So there's another really good hand he can get to the turn with. And then there's the nut flushes, other flushes. So Phil can have a lot of good hands going into the turn. And I think he can check those on the turn, especially after that small bet size on the flop. He's going to have a lot of weak hands. He's going to want to protect them, and he has hands to protect that way. And similarly on the river, on the river, the opponent is going to have some hands that missed and some good hands. And we've been through this before, but I think that Phil will want to bluff by check raising at least sometimes. And indeed, we know that he wanted to bluff by check raising at least sometimes because that's what he actually did. So I think we can account for a lot of passive actions from some of Phil's really strong hands here. And I also think there are more strong hands here than you might think there are just by kind of looking at the board and thinking shallowly about the hand. So that's my argument for why Phil did not have a face-up weak hand when he checked the river. And that's also part of my argument for why he probably wasn't just losing his mind when he moved all in on the river. I think he correctly assessed that he could have some good hands and play them this way. And I think Altman's pause was real. I think anybody would probably take a second to think it over or should on ESPN in, for a pot worth many real dollars, but he seemed genuinely anguished, even with what was probably the top of his range, very near the top of his range. He did make the call. I don't think he can fold Queen Jack here. Don't think he should, especially Queen Jack with blocker values. I think bet calling is a very good line on the river. I think Altman played the street very well. But you did kind of see the aw crap. I only need to be good 25% of the time here, but am I even good that often? Which makes me think that he might have gotten away from two aces, two kings, ace queen, a hand like that. Those hands are very, very plausible. And I think that those hands could fold to this action on the river. Again, the pot odds suggest that you only need to be good 25% of the time, but in reality, you need to be good a little bit more than that, or actually, quite a bit more than that. It would depend on things like the other stack sizes at the table and the exact spot in the tournament, etc. I think they were not quite to the money yet, for whatever that's worth. So that's my take on this hand. There's a lot more we could talk about here, but I think I've hopefully given you a few things to think about, and I hope to have addressed the normative question of whether Phil was right, whether Phil should have played his hand this way, and whether he just lost his mind by doing this so. There's also just the descriptive question of why Phil played the hand this way, just purely descriptively. What was he doing? I think mostly he was trying to play as well as possible, but I'm reminded of a section from one of Daniel Negreanu's video vlogs. I'm probably going to get this story slightly wrong, so I apologize for anything I get wrong. But I think the way this goes is that there was a $25,000 one day, or maybe 2 day, but I think one day tournament at the Aria. These go off every so often. They draw small, tough fields. And Daniel was going over to play, and he called Phil and said, "Hey, man, are you going to play this?" And Phil had obviously been woken up by Daniel's phone call, even though it was very late in the morning. He said, "What are you talking about?" "Phil, there's a tournament today, $25,000, Aria." And Phil says, "Yeah, how much for first?" And I've thought that that was just a beautiful little story. Or maybe it's too small to be called a story. Maybe it's just an anecdote. But to be playing for so much money against such tough players, and to have your first or possibly just only thought be how much is first place, I'm not quite sure what it says, but I know it says something about the mentality of elite or degenerate or both gamblers. I think that's another thing to keep in mind, is that Phil was thinking about the dollars and was not, like so many of us are, thinking about progressing minute by minute through the main event. Now, I think, I'm not sure, but think that Phil is properly taking tournament considerations into account. But if anything, I think he is not taking that stuff into account as much as the rest of us would. And he, more than maybe anybody else in the tournament, is just thinking about first place. So if he thinks he had a chip EV edge there by check raising, then I think he would do that. And I think he is probably valuing his survival a bit less than the rest of us might. Some of those reasons are, just pure mathematical ones, and others of them have made it may have more to do with his position or his psychology or whatever. But I thought I would share that story. And if anybody can remember which Daniel Negreanu vlog that's from, I would be grateful for that. Yeah, so there's a lot more to say about this hand, but that's the beginning of it. I would love to hear what you think about it. You can email us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. You can also tweet at me. I'm at Nate Mavis, NateMeyvis, V as in Victor, IS. I would love to hear from you. And I hope you have enjoyed thinking through this hand with me. I think one of the special things about poker, one of the special things about the World Series of Poker, one thing that I loved about playing it is having a hand just rattling around in my head for hours or days. It's a wonderful thing. You roll it over, more things occur to you. You think you've got it figured out, and then you talk about it with somebody over a ginger ale or over dinner. Then it turns out there's more to think about. And one special thing about these tournaments and about famous people playing these tournaments is that it gives us collectively a hand to all think about together. I think this hand will probably be remembered for a while, and I've certainly had a lot of pleasure carrying it around with me in my head and thinking about it for a while, and I hope to do that some more. So please think about it with me, tweet at me, email us. Again, thank you for listening this week. We will be back next week, hopefully with Andrew, possibly not, but hopefully with Andrew, or at least with somebody. And I hope you have a great week. Thanks. Take care.